This is the Real Footy Podcast. There are no games, but there's plenty of news. We'll get a club perspective on the AFL shutdown, talk player pay deals, go down memory lane with a Cats great, and much more.
A wing position on the member stand side. Oh, Jasolenko! You're guilty!
Tigers are going to win the premiership in 2017. The Tigers have got home for the first time in 37 years.
Cox throws it onto the left. One last roll of the dice for him.
Out in the minute, Lucas Redd at best, wrong side for him, hooks a ball, what a mark, sensational!
Hello and welcome, my name is Michael Gleeson, and joining us from self-quarantining, Jimmy Bartel, Giants director and former Brownlow medalist. Well, you're still a Brownlow medalist, but superstar of the game. Jimmy, welcome.
Thanks, Michael. I like how you always refer to my Giants directorship than my Cats playing days.
But, well, we'll get to that, but it is relevant to what we're talking about this week. And, of course, with us again, Caroline Wilson and Jake Nile. Welcome to you both.
Welcome, Michael, Caro, Jimmy.
Hey, Jake. Hey, Jim. Hi, Gleese. I'm imagining that the Cats great is also the Giants director for the purposes of today's podcast, which is wonderful news.
Well, that's what he took exception to, being called the Giants director before he was a player. But being a Giants director, Jimmy, is especially relevant to us at the moment to give us an idea of what it's like inside a club right now, the decisions that are being made, how you're handling a playing group. Can you just talk us through a bit of that?
Oh, look, it's extremely difficult at the moment. We're no different from any other industry. You know, some difficult decisions are being made. You're trying to, you know, get to the right amount of staff to be able to just keep the business running. But unfortunately, you're telling people that they don't have a job, or their job's been hit on pause. You know, there's no paychecks and the uncertainty in it. It's tough discussions going on, but it's happening at every club, and it's happening in every industry across Australia. From a Giants point of view, we've gone from about 95 staff down to 30, probably only two or three in the football department. A lot of it is in your commercial space, trying to protect a lot of your money, I guess, in your commercial space. And it's a difficult time, but you're just concerned about people at the moment. It's hard.
Jim, a month ago, we were talking about playing games in California. I guess that they just seem like one of the many indulgences of footy that is unlikely to happen anytime soon, certainly not for the next few years.
Yeah, I guess, Caro, it seems like an indulgence, but it also could be, I guess, something to aim for still, because the financial benefit of playing those sort of games for clubs, the only reason that some clubs have gone and played at different venues, you know, you think of in Northern Territory or even China, is the financial benefit off the back of that. I get when we come back, we've got to resume to, as you call it, as normal football as possible, you know, traditional football, if you want to put it better terms. But I don't think clubs, once they get through this, won't stop looking at ways to bring in additional revenue.
Jim, of the Californian ballot benefactors, you've got one of the biggest bond traders in the world as one of your club benefactors. The two gentlemen, I think it's Mark and is it Mark and Dan?
Yes, that's correct.
Have they come to the party to help the club in this time of need, where many clubs, you're guaranteed by the AFL effectively, but where your survival is arguably threatened?
Oh, I think every club's survival is threatened, Jake. I think, and I've listened to Tony Cochran speak a fair bit regarding the Gold Coast. I think it's a bit lazy sometimes for people just to think first in, first out, that, you know, the last two clubs in being Gold Coast and the Giants, let's just cut them and we'll be all fine. There's a lot more to that as far as the economics of football, as far as what the Giants and the Suns bring to the game. The additional game, you know, creates just over $40 million a year. It's new commercial revenue that comes into the game with the Giants and the Suns. It's not going to the same, you know, sort of banks and car dealerships in Victoria. It's new ground. So I get what you're saying, that, you know, the advantage we have is two gentlemen who are so passionate about the Giants and back that up financially. But I think we haven't got to that stage yet. I think all clubs are just looking, trying to, I guess, take this collegiate approach and all come through together.
Caro, do you agree with that? Or do you think that there is a threat to, or who do you think the threat will come to within the game when we get back to playing and when, you know, the new normal returns?
I can't help but think it's more the Victorian clubs that are under threat, Gleese. I think that 10 clubs in Victoria is one of the many it's not an indulgence, it's a given. But we're told by those who are trying to save the game that once the game is saved, and we all assume it will be saved, that the next part is the rebuild, and the rebuild will start with no givens. And there are some who think that, yeah, the last in, first out, and there is that view. And I've got to say, Jim, despite the collegiate approach, there are a few clubs who are saying that. There's certainly not that your survival is a given, but more common is this notion that, and it will damage the game, but the game has been damaged irrevocably, I feel. I mean, the good things about the game will keep it going, but I just can't see how, if you're going to get rid of clubs, you can justify 10 clubs in Victoria anymore, given this new financial model. And whether that means mergers, whether that means a merger with a Victorian club and, for example, the Gold Coast, and boy, aren't there a lot of people pointing the finger at North Melbourne at the moment, or in fact a merger with Tasmania. So I think that would be the danger area for mine.
I think, Caro, you're absolutely right that the AFL view is absolutely hard line on the Giants and the Suns. So that will place more pressure. Those clubs are there for the long haul, almost irrespective of what happens.
Jimmy, in more immediate terms regarding this season, what's your advice been from the AFL? Do you have any further insight than we do from the outside as to how the rest of the season could shape, assuming we get back playing at some point?
No, I think that has been a bit of a change from the AFL, and you three have, you know, lots more touch points than I do with the AFL and people at different clubs. But the thing I've found from the AFL is how transparent they've been in this time. There's been no hiding behind it. Caro, I've heard you speak a number of times that they're not trying to play games. This is not a negotiation. They just need to know where every single club is at first financially. Then they've also just been dictated to by, obviously, you know, the health experts of where the game can get back on. And I think that's why they set tentatively May 31st. Let's have a look, see where, I guess, society's at as well, where we're at financially, and then let's try and get a season back on. My opinion is, even if it's May 31st, you still need clubs another 3 to 4 weeks to get a run in and play. So you've got to get players back from home states. You've got to get them back up and training, because you can't just roll them straight into a game a week later. So you need to have some training under their belt first, so we don't have that round going out and every second player popping hamstrings and things like that. So I think whatever date they reassess, plus another 3 to 4 weeks on top of that.
Jim, I've got two questions from you in terms of the players. The first one is, you're a football director the club sought for a long time, as in a former high-profile star footballer, to be on the board. Are you playing a role, first of all, in communicating with those players? And I assume quite a few have gone back to their home states.
Yeah, well, firstly, just speaking to them generally, you just want to see how people are doing. And I think everyone's doing that, not only in football, but any business. You just want to touch base with everyone, because once people leave the club, you know, it's a lot harder to, you know, keep those points of contact. So just keeping in touch with as many players as possible. I've had quite a few chats to, you know, Phil Davis and Steve Cornelio and the leaders of the group, even Toby Green. You just want to see how they're going, and you shoot off a few messages to even guys like Tim Taranto, who he's on long-term injury list. So again, you're isolated, and then you're isolated even more trying to do rehab during this time as well. So I think it's just more from a personal point of view, and then you talk a little bit of football after that.
And secondly, you're, well, R3AW Saturday pre-game, when we eventually do have a Saturday pre-game again on 3AW, Lee Matthews said that he had lost he'd lost respect or faith in the players for the stand that is obviously over now because a deal has been reached. But did you agree with Lee, or do you think he was being too harsh on the players last week?
No, I understand Lee's comments because I actually feel like the players and the Players Association probably their PR, if you want, campaign of this was handled poorly. I think the language being used by not only key personnel like Pat Dangerfield and Paul Marsh wasn't great. But I, speaking to them, I understand what they were trying to say, but I just don't think they communicated that properly. So that's when, you know, the likes of Lee Matthews and other football commentators or people commenting on the game felt like, well, what are the players doing? You know, so I just think they didn't communicate their message very well.
Jimmy, how's Toby Green dealing with self-isolating?
Probably like most. I think a lot of Melbourne media have a fascination with Toby Green, and I think we saw a lot of people in recent times are starting to get to know Toby and actually see him as the footballer. And I think the best thing that happened for him was playing in that state game for Victoria.
And just another one, Jeremy Cameron is on a extremely, this is not a big secret, on a very big amount of money this year in his final year as a free agent. Do you have any idea how the club can navigate that situation where it's arguably very unfair to players who have either front-loaded contracts in 2020 or very back-loaded contracts?
Yeah, I understand that, Jake. But again, there's this extra fascination with Giants players out of contract that I don't see how it's any different from Collingwood trying to negotiate, you know, key personnel and key players at the same time. There's this strange thing that even at round one, Harry Perryman plays an absolute brilliant game, the best game of his career, kicks four goals off the wing. And the first article we see out of Melbourne-based media is, oh, here come the big contract offers for Harry Perryman.
It's like, that's not right, Tim.
That is.
Absolutely. You've got a bit of a chip on your shoulder.
No, I don't, but people,
the first thing that was said.
It was
not the first thing. People were absolutely raving about Perryman's game.
Of course they were. And then followed up with, the Giants will need to increase their contract offer to keep Harry Perryman now. Just let it.
Well, we're asking you the question. We're asking you the question
and
because you're a Giants director. Did I read the other day that you've assured Leon Cameron's contract, that's been assured even though it won't be done now, is that right?
Pretty much. We love Leon as a coach and things like that, but like everyone in the AFL industry, there's no contracts to be signed off. Everything's hit pause until we see what the outcome of all what's going on at the moment.
Now, Jimmy, just to get back to get you to actually answer Jake's question rather than get on the defensive and try and whack Melbourne media for being Melbourne-centric, how do you handle the fact that some players are on front and back-ended contracts that they've signed to help the club with their salary cap, and some of them are going to be relatively, and we use this word unadvisedly, relatively worse off or punished for that in this year where the pay cuts are taking effect?
Michael, across 800 odd players, there's going to be a lot affected. This is once in a 100-year sort of scenario we've got going on. This is not, you know, a pay dispute or anything. We're talking about a virus that's spreading around the world. Of course, some players are going to be affected.
Hang on, are you a politician? That's again a non-answer, Jimmy.
Some players are going to be affected, Jake.
I'm not sure what answer you're looking for, Jake. You asked me whether players will be affected by a coronavirus.
Okay, I'll name the players. Jeremy Cameron and Josh Kelly. They are both free agents or
out of contract this year.
But what's the question? You've just stated their free agency. Everyone knows that. But I'm not sure what you're wanting me to answer. You've asked, will they be affected? I'm sure there is plenty of players affected. You've asked their free agents. Of course they're free agents, but the whole industry is on pause at the moment. I'm not sure what you want me to answer there.
All right. Well, what about answering? Can you answer something along the lines of this? How will the club cope, as all clubs will be confronting this, with going into a national draft, which Gill says we will still have, despite the fact that it won't be an under-18 season and most of the recruiting staff at football clubs have been stood down? So we'll have basically a list manager full-time now assessing talent that he hasn't seen for 12 months, going into a national draft at some point in the next 6 months.
Yeah, that's going to be extremely difficult. I was thinking about that the other day, you know, with the TAC Cup and those other state-based competitions. You know, do you just increase the draft age for 1 year? or, you know, they're already in the TAC Cup, allow 19-year-olds to play. Do you increase the amount of 19-year-olds each in the TAC Cup can play so they can get some football? Do we get, I guess, you know, 6 to 8 weeks of underage football so they can play, you know, in October, November? They just need to see them. Look, your top 10 or top 20, I think most clubs already have a gauge on, but it's the rest that we're not sure about. The other interesting one is, would you consider producing a veterans list for another year? So, like, the likes of Gary Ablett and Sean Burgoyne and things like that, because, you know, a lot of people would have assumed if they played the whole year, it would have been their last year, but they've hit pause, so they're not putting any more kilometres on the body. Would you consider maybe sort of like a veterans list for those type of players, because they're probably most likely to be prepared to back up and play again?
Is that harder to sell, that idea, when the talk is going the other direction with list sizes? I mean, rather than talking about adding veterans, all the conversation is about trimming back to 35.
Yeah, I think the trim back to 35 would still have to allow, you know, like your Category B types of players and things like that, because it sort of flies in the face of developing the game and getting players from, you know, like your Mason Cox or your Zach Tui from Ireland and America. If you trim it back to 35, are you going looking for those players again?
Oh, can I ask Jimmy one? Jimmy, if the season's not complete, do we have a Brownlow medal as a former Brownlow medalist? If we get to 8 games, 10 games, do we go ahead and have a Brownlow?
Yeah, I don't know what the threshold is. What was as a supporter, as a fan, you have to have more than half a season, don't you?
I reckon you've got to play every team. I reckon you've got to go 17 rounds or it's not a season.
Yeah, I'm with you there, Michael. I think you've got to make it almost a valid season, you've got to play everyone once, don't you?
Yeah.
If you don't have a premiership, I don't see how you can have a Brownlow medalist, would be my view.
Well, that raises the listener question from Jason, who asks, if the season does not go ahead and 2020 is a write-off, does this year count as a year on a player contract, or does it reset for next year that players stay on? Or players on one-year deals, could they be in trouble if this year counts? What do you think, Jake?
I think that it this year counts because they've got a pay deal. They're getting paid. As it stands today, Michael, they're getting paid for one game, and if there's no more games, they'll walk out still with about 70, close to 70% of their money thereabout. So absolutely it counts. If you get paid, then that's your contract.
Have the Giants been asking that question, Jim?
Yeah, I'm sure they are. We've only just gotten the players' pay deal for, you know, while we've got no football at the moment. So there's so many questions with that. You know, you obviously players, they will get paid, Jake, but a number of them probably have got trigger clauses with the total amount of games to get them into another contract. What do you do with that? Normally that's based around conservatively, 15 to 16 games, Jake, that players have to roll into the next year?
I think Jimmy's referring to a conversation we had a couple of years ago when he had a trigger clause and we were on air together and I brought it up.
Jake knew my contract better than I did.
Oh, well.
Hey, Jim, I would say the players have done pretty well with this negotiation. What would your view be?
Yeah, I think they have. But as I said earlier, I just think the way that the language they used, I guess, in the way they were trying to explain it wasn't done well. But I think it's landed in a pretty good spot.
Jim, also, one other one. You've always been an advocate for playing the grand final at Western Sydney or down at Cadinia Park. This idea that we could be playing grand final right through until the end of December, is this the precursor to moving the grand final away from the MCG?
Well, I'm not sure what else we're going to do, because I think everyone is just very presumptuous that we'll play a grand final at the G, but cricket have got a T20 World Cup. They've got India coming. They're not going to give up anything, are they? So they've got to make money as well. So it might have to be the year where we play somewhere else. Look, by all means, go down and play it at Bell Park. I think that's a fantastic ground to host a grand final down there in Geelong, the west of Geelong.
California, Jim. California, maybe?
Look, I'm sure you'll be the first to jump on a plane and go to California, Jake. I know you enjoy your sunbaking. You're currently in the Banana Lounge doing this podcast at the moment, so you'd be well prepped.
Might have to send it back to Waverley and have angry Anderson.
Oh, the AFL own Marvel Stadium, and if it's Victorian clubs, I'm sure it'll be there if the MCG doesn't, or cricket doesn't come to the party. But everyone's had to give up something, and I reckon there are people running the MCG that are very keen to keep the grand final there and that some deal might be done with cricket, but far too early to say. We're being optimistic at the moment, even looking forward to a grand final, Glees.
All right, we'll take a break there. We'll come back and talk to Jimmy about things that he's not so sensitive about.
We're online all the time. Just search Age Real Footy on Facebook or Twitter.
And Stokes goes to full forward, hooks it back, wanting Bartel. Bartel, clever! Brilliant! Unbelievable, actually. They're in front. Jimmy with a bit of magic.
Well, before he was the world's most famous football director of an AFL club, Jimmy Bartel was also an AFL footballer. Brownlow medalist, superstar of the game. We thought we'd have a look at some of your games. Jimmy, tell us off the top your favourite AFL match.
Oh, well, apart from the grand finals and the premiership wins, probably it's strange. I loved the Easter Monday games. They were my favourite games of the year with the Hawks. But probably the game that, and it was a loss, was that Geelong v St Kilda game at now Marvel Stadium, both sides undefeated. And it's pretty rare where you walk off the ground in a loss and you feel satisfied. And it sounds strange, but when you come up against the absolute best at that stage, the Saints, they were stacked side. We had a stacked side. But, you know, those build-ups and they sort of normally fall flat. But when both sides play at their absolute peak and it comes down to Michael Gardner taking a massive pack grab to win, you can sort of walk off and go, geez, that's exactly what football and why you train and play and do everything is about.
Before we get back onto your footy career, we've talked a lot about professionalism, going back to semi-professionalism. I want to ask about one of the most famous games you played that wasn't footy, that cricket game. And look, first of all, I mean, I remember at the time thinking it was a bit rough that you got all that flack for it, but I'm wondering now whether we might go back to those days and whether you think that would be a good thing.
Yeah, it's strange how times have changed. I think I played the Hawks on a Friday night and on a cricket grand final on the Saturday. I'd committed to play with a lot of my mates down there at Colindina. We had the cricket grand final, and I just thought, well, I'd be doing recovery anyway. What's better than walking in the beach is going and playing, you know, couple of overs, 75 overs each day in a cricket grand final. But times have changed a bit. I'd like to see players be able to, well, they've been trying to do it, haven't they? Players have been trying to have a life outside of football and get that mental break, as they say.
Just on that game, Jimmy, that you played.
The cricket, I made about 40-odd, Jake, and took a couple of wickets.
The game you played against the Saints, the round 14 game, I think it was, as you're referring to, that game, round 15, did you guys walk off the ground in that game thinking, next time we play them, if it's the grand final, we'll get them?
I think we didn't walk off the ground going, oh, we can't beat them. Obviously, we knew we were as evenly matched as possible. I think the thing that ended up happening for us, and this is, again, my point of view from it, is you remember grand final week 2009, it rained the whole entire time, the grand final parade. But during the whole season, we played so many games down at GMHBA Stadium or Cadinia Park in the rain and the wet, whereas that year the Saints had played, I think, about 16 or 17 games under the roof. So you sort of, as a Geelong player, you thought, well, keep raining. We're used to playing that slow, grinding football. The Saints were super defensive, so it would have helped. But we saw it as a bit of an advantage with the weather, you know, coming down as hard as it did on grand final day. So we were already confident enough we were good enough to beat them, Jake. But I think when it started to belt rain, I think we thought it sort of came to us a little bit more.
Did you in particular think that? You always had a good record in the wet.
I just thought we were a good side in the wet. I just thought that was the way we played. We batted really deep in the midfield. So when you have wet days and super physical days, you need lots of really hard physical guys. And you just look at that Cat side, that midfield rotation was about 12 deep when you think about it, because you had Chapman and Johnson, you know, standing at half forward. Selwood was only in his third year coming off the bench. Like, you had players everywhere to come through the midfield. You'd even put Max Rook through there, Joel Corey going back. You know, you just had James Kelly. You had plenty of players who could come in and do that, you know, bash and crash work around the ball. And when it's pouring rain, that's all the game becomes.
And Jimmy, you were asked to sacrifice a bit in that grand final to go on to a rampant Lenny Hayes at quarter time.
Yeah, well, Lenny was going bananas. I think he had 10 or 11 and kicked a goal. I still remember Bomber Thompson coming, flying down from the coach's box, and I'd started at half forward. So Geelong, they'd either start myself or Gary at half forward, then you come up, you know, up the ground as sort of an extra midfielder, and that was my role. And I got a bit of the ball myself, but then Bomber came flying down and goes, "Have you got Lenny Hayes?" I go, "No, you've got me at half forward." And then he pretty much goes, "Well, you've got him for the rest of the game. Don't let him touch it." And that was the only instruction he gave me for the whole game. So that was the tagging move he made. But geez, Lenny was an absolute superstar. And we spoke about that game at round 14 game, and he was dominant in that as well.
Is that the only time you were a tagger?
Different times actually during that season. They'd sort of sent me across to a player if he'd gotten away. So I think a couple of times during the year I might have spent a quarter on someone and I think Brendan McCartney, it was his idea that we sort of needed one or two players who could go do that just in case. Because, of course, Cameron Ling would be the number one chief tagger. Yeah. So Lingy would go to Del Santo, you know, for the Saints. But if the opposition then had another one get off the chain, could we have another midfielder sort of play a bit defensive on off, not a hard tag, but play that sort of role? So we sort of were prepping through the year to do that just in case.
Jim, what goal do you get asked most about? We've just heard one unbelievable effort. And on the middle of the MCG before the round one Richmond-Carlton game, Tim Lane was asking you about another goal from a pocket, as I recall.
Yeah, he asked me about a snap out of the pocket, I think it was. I think Jared Healy thinks I should have centred it, but he didn't have any faith in me kicking the goal. But I actually get more asked about a point than anything else. I get asked about the point I kicked after the siren against the Hawks on one of those Easter Monday clashes. I think everyone is more fascinated about a shot that I didn't kick for a goal than anything else.
The other game, you say that Geelong St Kilda game, I think you think that's the best game, one of the best games you've ever witnessed, certainly ever played in. What about the Geelong Hawthorn game of 2012 when Tomahawk gold?
Can go the distance.
Well, we want to freshen up here. This for the game then. Kicker's on the way. Siren's gone. They've done it again. They've done it again, the Cats.
Oh, that was insane. I still look at the Tom Hawkins goal, and I'm a big footy nut. I love the history of footy. And the thing that fascinates me about Tom Hawkins' goal, I keep watching it, where he kicks it from, he's almost on the back of the square. But you watch how far it actually ends up going through. It goes goalpost height. He's kicked it like 65, which reminds me of, you know, they always show the replays grand final time, Collingwood, North Melbourne, and is it Twiggy Dunn who
kicks
the barrel?
Twiggy Dunn in 77. Yeah, he's 30 out.
Yeah, have you ever watched, though, it's 30 out? It goes about 40 metres into the stand. He's kicked it about 60. That always blows my mind.
But he's 30 out and he kicks a torpedo.
Yeah, he kicks a torpedo. Or Malcolm Blight's, you know, kick where he's kicked it from, it's now out to 95 metres, but it's still going through a goalpost height. So back to that game, Caro, the Tom Hawkins one, I still can't get over how far he's actually flushed the footy to win the game. And it was dead centre the whole way. But it was classic Geelong Hawthorn. One side gets out, one reels the other one in. It just was always back and forth.
You shut down Lenny Hayes that day. Who was the hardest opponent you had?
Had plenty of hard ones. I think the thing that sticks in my mind the most, I think it was my third AFL game. We're playing the great Brisbane Lions up at the Gabba in 2002. I remember walking over to the centre bounce, the first bounce. I was playing my third game. James Kelly was playing his first game. And I think Lingy came into the centre bounce as well. And the three of us stood there and went, "All right, Michael Voss, Brownlow medalist, probably won't take him. Simon Black, Brownlow medalist, won't take him. Jason Ackermanis, oh, Brownlow medalist, won't take him. How about we go out to a wing? Oh, there's Nigel Lappin, probably, you know, five-time All-Australian. all right, let's try and swap the half forward. Who was the quickest one to get out of the square? That was an absolute baptism that night. That was the hardest night of football I think I've played, because like that was unbelievable, that Brisbane side. They always gave us huge headaches. I used to get tagged a lot by Josh Carr from Port Adelaide. He used to punch the suitcase out of me for about four quarters. So, yeah, some pretty tough games against him.
And, Jim, you talked about the game against St Kilda that was a rare time that you walked off the ground and you didn't feel devastated. What was the one, do you ever look back on the biggest one that got away?
Oh, clearly.
The most devastating?
Clearly 2008. Obviously, Hawthorn, you got to give credit to Hawthorn, though. Well, I think we were just going through that final series. You look at the Hawks through that final series, they were flying. You go to our prelim that got us in the grand final. The Doggies probably should have really rolled us in the prelim. I think Sean Higgins might have hit the post. We won by about 10 points in the end. But, of course, if you ever get to a grand final and you lose one, you do all the what-ifs and the maybes and all that sort of stuff. But, yeah, that was probably the most devastating loss that you could have.
Jimmy, does it miff you, as it does some Geelong people, that you were a three-flag team, which is fantastic in the five-year stretch, but that your main opponent, Hawthorn, got four flags over an eight-year period, and I think most people, certainly me, would say that the Geelong team over a period was better.
Being a player, of course, you're naturally greedy and things like that, and, this is just purely my opinion. I think, and it's probably what you're asking, Jake, I think we left a couple on the table as well too. Was it 2000, what year did the Dogs win there, 16, was it?
Yep.
2016. I think we missed one there. We came out so poorly that first quarter against the Swans. I think we missed one there. Hawks 2013, I think we coughed up a four-goal lead at three-quarter time in the prelim. Of course, 2008, Hawthorn rolled us, and we were probably the best side all year, but Hawthorn were the best side of the last 5 to 6 weeks. So I sort of agree with you, Jake. I think we missed a couple as well.
Where do you keep the medals, Jim?
Good question. I'm not 100% sure, to be honest. I think one of my nephews, they all shared out. I've got seven nephews with my two sisters. Have got seven boys between them. Each one of them have sort of got something. I think my mum's got my Brownlow, and my niece has actually got my Norm Smith medal. So it's all dotted out everywhere. I'm not a big memorabilia person. The only memorabilia I've got is just, the old school team photo after the premiership where it's just the 22 and the coach there, probably the three photos I've got.
That's right. Well, that is all we have time for this week. Thanks to Jimmy, Jake and Caro for joining us. And thanks to Channel 7, Fox Footy and Channel 10 for the audio we've used in this episode. If you want to get in touch, you can email us at the address realfootypod@theage.com.au or give us a call on 03-8667-1235. Thanks as always for listening, and we'll catch you next time.